From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Pulitzer Prize winner Timothy Egan joins us this week. His books include The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, which won the National Book Award. And his latest book is the fascinating history, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. Timothy Egan, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, Gary. It's great to be with you.
Before we get to talking about your book, since you, I think you're our first guest that's won the Pulitzer Prize, tell us a little bit about that.
It actually wasn't as much fun as the National Book Award. You know, you go, as an author, you go long periods, long times, many days and years where you wonder if you're ever even going to get published, anyone's ever going to read you. And so, you know, when you finally get that end of it, it's just you think there's an imposter. You think they have the wrong name, the wrong person. It's nice. I mean, we did a year-long series about 7 years ago, I think, on how race has lived in America. We tried to go really deep, really beneath the subject. And a lot of the stuff you're seeing this year with the first African-American president that's coming to the surface, we tried to explore with these personal narratives. So it was really a fun project, really one of the best things I've done in journalism, just in terms of spending time with subjects.
And that was in the New York Times?
Yes, that was in the New York Times, exactly. And then the Book Award thing was just a complete and utter surprise, and you just never think it's going to happen. And again, I think someone's going to come in the middle of the night and take it away from
me. Take it back.
Yeah, exactly.
So do they have, you know, is it like the Emmys? Do they have a ceremony in which they say, and the nominees are, or you just get a phone call that says you've won the National Book Award?
Well, that's a great question. Because for the Pulitzers, you get a phone call saying you've won, and then you go to this really formal, stiff lunch where you aren't even acknowledged. You just sort of eat the rubber chicken, and you know, somebody talks at Columbia University, and then one of my colleagues said, "Is that all there is?" At the National Book Awards, it's the Oscars for books, and nobody knows until they actually open the envelopes. There's 3 days of, I mean, no writer is ever treated better in America. It's like being, you know, Derek Jeter in New York during World Series week. And you go around, you read at different universities, you're given this nominee medal that you wear for 3 days, which I thought someone was going to steal from me when I went on the subway. And then you go to this gala thing with 900 people, including all these writers you've always read and dreamed of bumping into, and they open these envelopes. So it is like the Oscars in that sense.
Very exciting, then.
It's just enormously exciting.
Now, and you won the National Book Award for your book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl. And now your new book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. So you're fascinated by the way the environment affects history?
Yeah, you know, the thing I'm really interested, this is what I've been interested in since I was a little kid, actually, is just the collision between nature and human beings, and you know how human beings react with hubris toward nature. And I've written about this in a lot of New York Times stories over the years. I covered the Exxon Valdez oil spill, the worst oil spill in American history, which was actually my journalistic break. I got hired because of this awful oil spill. And I've covered a lot of forest fires. I covered Hurricane Katrina, and you know, I'm really interested just in how we sort of push it. And I covered the Bay Area earthquake. I think that's Loma Prieta, wasn't it?
Yes, 1989. We were here.
Right, and that was when the San Francisco Giants played the Oakland Athletics, and
yes,
there was this marvelous headline in one of the papers the next day that said, "Nature bats last." And somebody made a T-shirt out of that too. That's really my theme in a nutshell: is nature bats last. That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Well, so you come at it. Do you come at it as a historian or as an environmentalist or what?
Neither. I'm not a trained historian, and I don't like to call myself that. Still to term environmentalist. I love the outdoors. My mother, you know, gave me a love of the outdoors when I was a kid, and so, you know, I live in the Pacific Northwest, where we like to think we're fairly close to nature, just as you are in Santa Cruz, that, you know, we're surrounded by envy and a lot of really magnificent stuff. So, you know, I come at it just from being fascinated by these by story. That's the main thing I'm driven by, is story. I look for story. I look for, you know, in the Dust Bowl, it was almost a fable, almost a parable. We take this biggest, most beautiful grassland ever endowed anywhere on the planet, the second largest ecosystem in North America, and in a generation's time, we turn it over. And then it gets its revenge. The skies dump this, you know, epic siege of dirt and everything else down on the folks who turned this grass over. Now, with the fire, you have a similar thing. You have a fire that's 3 million acres in 36 hours. So you had that big fire in Southern California in late August, early September, and you know, made quite a bit of news. That fire was 100,000 acres. This was 3 million acres, and it burned in a weekend. So again, it's a great collision, a great sort of melding of human beings and our sense that we can control nature, and then, as I said a few moments ago, nature batting last.
Now, you knew about this story for a long time before you wrote about it.
Yes, it was mythic, and in two senses. I mean, I'm a native of Seattle. I'm a third-generation Northwesterner, but I grew up on the eastern side in eastern Washington. My family would take me to Montana and Idaho to camp, and everybody talked about this fire. Even in the 1970s, 1960s, it had this mythic resonance to it. You could see a few of the skeletons of these standing dead, charred trees that were around, and these, you know, patches that had been burned, these plaques that marked where a town had once been that was now wiped off the map. And then flash forward 25 years later, I'm covering fires for the New York Times, including fires like the Yellowstone fire of 1992, which burned half of the park. And people are still talking about the big burn. I didn't realize how important it was to, A, the founding mythology of conservation in the Forest Service, but B, to a lesson that was somewhat wrongfully learned, and we can get into that in a moment.
Yeah. Now, where was this gigantic fire?
It was burned parts of three states, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. If you look at a map of the United States and you look at the northern Rockies region, it actually was the last area in the continental United States to be settled by Anglos. There was a fairly significant native population in there of Nez Perce and Coeur d'Alene Indians and Flathead Indians and Bitterroots, but Anglos didn't come to it till late, basically the 20th century. So it's northern Idaho, western Montana, and far mountainous northeastern Washington, and then a little bit of British Columbia.
We're talking, by the way, if you're just joining us, with Timothy Egan, and his new book is called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. Well, how did the fire begin? It was a weather-related fire?
Yeah, it was one of these long, hot, dry summers that we get in the West every now and then. It basically stopped raining in April. And this is an area that's used to getting about 35 to 40 inches of rain a year. And the faucet was just turned off after April. So it was a long, dry summer. Now, that's one thing. People can deal with that. But then you had these lightning sparks. Every night they would have these thunder boomers, but it was dry lightning. No rain would ever follow. Now, that's also fairly typical. So these little blazes were burning up in the high reaches of the northern Rockies, mostly started by lightning. And then, and I have a chapter on this, one day, these hurricane force, it was just a collision of weather systems, these hurricane force winds blew out of eastern Washington and blew into this region where these smaller fires were going, and the whole thing just blew up. It became one of these, its own weather system fires, a fire feeding on oxygen, a fire going faster, as they frequently said, than anyone could run or that a horse could run either. A fire with, now, hurricane force winds are 72 miles an hour, and these winds were clocked at anywhere from 70 to 110 miles an hour. So it just sucked everything out of there. It just fed on fuel, and then it sent flames off through what's called spotting, where the tops of the trees sort of shoot flames forward, and it just became this force of nature of itself. So again, to try to give your listeners some perspective, imagine if the entire state of Connecticut was destroyed in a weekend. That's how big this thing was. But it was this freak of nature. These winds came in a very dry period.
And was this a sparsely inhabited area?
Not really. This had been the site of a very strange part of American history when basically these miners went in rebellion and blew up some tracks and blew up some mines, and later a governor was assassinated. It was the site of a real workers' revolt, and they called it anarchy, and they sent in the United States Army just 5 years earlier. So it was a sort of a worldwide center of labor attention. people were there because of mines. They were there because of timber riches, and they were there because they wanted to get the last of this really big piece of America that had not been gnawed at yet. And that's why I bring in Roosevelt, because he, 5 years earlier, he had just created the United States Forest Service with this audacious experiment. Can you set aside all this public land and give it to the people? And these Gilded Age powers, big common names like Weyerhaeuser and Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan, the well-known sort of fat cats of the late, you know, Gilded Age, wanted a piece of it. So they were moving into there too for the timber and the mining.
They were opposed to the idea of a Forest Service?
They were opposed to the idea of public land in general. And several United States senators from the area, including one who was arguably the most corrupt senator in U.S. history, named Senator Clark, Clark County in Las Vegas is named for him, by the way. He once said, I never bought a man who was not for sale. And he purchased votes with $100 bills in a monogrammed envelope. That's when senators were chosen by legislators. He said he would go to his dying day trying to prevent another acre of land being put into the public system. So they were opposed to the idea of national forests. So at the time this fire happened, Teddy Roosevelt had just left office, and his Forest Service was sort of orphaned, and they were having the crap kicked out of them. There were these little towns that were routing them. There were these whoring, saloning, deadwood kind of towns in the national forests. And then you had these Gilded Age powers who were poised for the kill. They had people in Congress who were ready to kill the Forest Service off. And so the fire had the effect of essentially saving, though it destroyed or though it burned 3 million acres, it saved this experiment of Roosevelt's, which was the United States Forest Service. So that's why I call it the fire that saved America.
Where did President William Howard Taft stand on the national parks?
Well, Taft actually, we wouldn't stand very long because he was 350 pounds, so he sat quite a bit. And one of the things that Taft was criticized for was bringing a huge bathtub into the White House. They called him Aft Taft whenever they saw him. He ballooned more than 100 pounds in the first year in office and had gout as well. Roosevelt hand-selected Taft, thinking he would follow the progressive-era policies of the Republican Teddy Roosevelt. But Taft was more of a mainstream Republican, somewhat befuddled, very malleable, and really wanted just to be liked. So he didn't want to risk his, he didn't want to stick his neck out. So as they chipped away at the Forest Service, Taft sort of went along with it.
And so what happened? Tell us how the Forest Service... Did they snap to action when this fire broke?
Yeah, it's an amazing story, really. Never before had the United States tried. I mean, it's so common now, especially where you folks live in California, to marshal these huge forces, almost army-like forces of land, air, sea, of yellow-shirted soldiers going into the woods, of air tanks, and all this sort of, you know, billion-dollar-plus arsenal of firefighting. Well, we had never done this before. The United States had never consciously tried to fight a wildfire on public lands or anywhere for that matter. They'd fought, you know, fires in the cities and towns, but never fought a wildfire before.
A wildfire, they would just let it burn as part of nature? Or that was the
yeah,
problem?
And there was it was so sparsely settled. That was the other thing. It was mm-hmm. just, and they didn't have the infrastructure. They didn't have roads. They didn't have cars. This is 1910. The automobile is basically a go-kart with, you know, with larger wheels. The Air Force has two planes. So they didn't have the infrastructure. They didn't have the material. You're right, Gary, they would let it go. And so they decided to, because it was so, this thing was so threatening, they decided to marshal all these forces. Before the actual blow-up, they assembled 10,000 firefighters, mostly immigrants and poor people, poor Irish, poor Italian, poor Slovenians, poor Bosnians, poor Latinos, folks, college kids, and they were under the control of this young Forest Service, which was basically a bunch of Yale kids. They were a bunch of college kids who came out of Yale, trained in this Gifford Pinchot, Teddy Roosevelt love of progressive era nature and you know how public land could be the keystone of progressive politics. So they were directing these people.
So really class played an issue in this whole
thing. A huge issue. I mean, I have a chapter called Deadwood Days. It's a culture clash of what happens when these Yaleys arrive in these, you know, there's one town I'll just give you. It was called Taft. They actually named it for Taft. They had more murders in Taft, Montana than anywhere in the United States 1 year per capita. When the snow melted, they found 18 bodies around the town. They had one prostitute for every four people, and a Chicago Sun-Times reporter called it the bodiest town the most wicked town in the United States. So it was a class thing. You're absolutely right. So you had these Yaleys going out to the woods, infused with Roosevelt's progressive era idea of early environmentalism, meeting these Deadwood Days drunks and Gilded Age types and people trying to gnaw away at the forest, just ignoring the fact that it was public land, taking the timber, putting towns in the national forest. And so you got 10,000 people all poised to fight fire under the control of about 200 young rangers, who none of whom knew what they were doing. Nobody had ever fought a fire of this magnitude before. And boom, on August 21st, 1910, almost 100 years ago, the thing blows up. And what happens? It erases five towns from the map. It kills about 100 people. And it becomes world news, not just American news. The New York Times covered it, gave it front page stories. It was covered all over the world. It was this big, giant blow-up in 1910. And it made martyrs out of these people. Suddenly, these young forest rangers who've been treated as a bunch of sissy college kids, which is what they called them, some of the newspapers called them Teddy's Green Rangers. They're out here on holiday. They don't know what they're doing. It made heroes out of them. It martyred them, and it had the effect of saving the Forest Service.
The deaths were a result of the fast-moving flames or fighting the fire? Or why were the smoking?
A combination of things. The deaths were really horrible. A lot of people suffocated in these tunnels. They were up in the high country fighting fire, and suddenly they would retreat to a tunnel, and they just died in there because of the poisonous gases, the CO2 that got in there and all the oxygen being sucked out. Others were burned alive. The people who survived just described these horrific things of their skin just peeling off and their faces melting to skeletons as the flames moved over them and consumed all their flesh. And then there were still others, some immigrants whom I traced back to the old country, some Italian immigrants and Irish immigrants, who died when giant 200-foot-long trees fell on them, pinned them down, and then they burned to death while pinned under these trees. Others still retreated to the streams and had these little reeds, these little straws, where they'd try to breathe the air while the fire swept over them. Most of those people lived by immersing themselves in these streams. So the deaths were all horrific. Now, those who survived is another part of the story. They were rangers who were made heroes by the national press, but were ultimately mistreated by their government. They never got proper medical care. They went through life miserable and bitter, that they had these horrible burns and scars. Like soldiers, they had basically sacrificed for what they called the great cause of Roosevelt, which was public land, which was setting aside this land for all people. And then they felt bitter at how they'd been treated.
We're talking with Timothy Egan, and his book is called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. It almost sounds like you're talking about the volunteers who went down to Ground Zero in 2001 and subsequently suffered for that.
You know, I hadn't thought of that, but that's a great parallel. Would you mind if I use that?
Go right ahead.
That's absolutely true. I mean, these people were heroic in the purest sense of the word. They believed in the national forest. They didn't make hardly any money, these rangers. They were infused with this, again, with this Roosevelt progressive era idea that that they could take a big piece of America and keep it in its original state. And then when these awful things happened to them, they couldn't believe their country would betray them.
Now, you say in your book that the lessons learned by the Forest Service were the wrong lessons. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's one of the most fascinating things. I mean, you know, they always say that we don't learn from history. You know, Voltaire said that history doesn't repeat itself. Human beings repeat themselves. It's fascinating what happened to this. Whether you care about this fire or not, it is with us in every wildfire fighting effort that you see right now in California, in Arizona, in New Mexico, in Colorado. Because after this fire, Forest Service essentially went from being the Forest Service, which is a very, you know, progressive, committed to saving public land, to being the Fire Service. And they started this thing called the 10 o'clock rule that said any time a fire appeared the day before, it had to be put out by 10 o'clock the next day. So their primary mission became to put out forest fires. And in that sense, the timber industry sort of co-opted them, because they were putting out fires to save timber, which now was ultimately sold to the timber industry. So it became a great deal for private profiteers who had fought the Forest Service, because suddenly they were the people who were saving timber so that they could go in and cut it later. But the main thing was, fire became the enemy. And for almost 100 years, the primary mission of the Forest Service was to kill fire. And in so doing, all this fuel built up all over the American West. And so the big, big fires that we see today, going back to Yellowstone, I think was 1992, and the Colorado wildfires of a few years ago, the Arizona fires, and who knows what's going to happen still with California this year. Most of those, in one way or another, the fuel buildup can be blamed on the big burn of 1910, which they fought every fire. And so, you know, fire is a force of nature. It has to burn in some, it has cycles. In some cases, there are only 10-year cycles. Other forests are 30-year cycles, but it has to burn. And so all this fuel buildup came from the wrong lesson, which was we will fight every fire. I mean, Smokey the Bear came out of that. Now, the point is not that we should, you know, let everything burn, or should we fight every fire, but it's that you look at these things and you try to put fire back into it, put it in its place there, which is, some of that has happened in the last few years.
I mean, a lot of the criticism that came after the big Yellowstone fire that you mentioned was that they had let it burn for too long, right?
Yes, and that was the first time, I'm glad you brought that up, that was the first time in American public policy that we sort of looked at wildfires and said, this baby has to burn. And I covered that fire, and people were just furious. They were wiring their senators and burning up the talk radio and saying, how dare they let this park burn? Well, you know, they were saying the park has to burn. It's a 100-year fire cycle, most of that lodgepole pine. And so, yeah, that was the first time they did it. It was very controversial. They've since refined it much more than it was then, but that was a sort of a rough introduction of letting fire back into nature.
Now, this story, unlike your last book, The Worst Hard Time, The Untold Story of Those Who Survived the Great American Dust Bowl, I mean, when you were writing that book, there were survivors of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression, but I don't think that anybody around today was around during the Big Burn.
No, and that was really hard for me because actually the last survivor of the Titanic, which happened 2 years after the Big Burn, died the other day, and this person was, I think, 2 years old.
Right.
So if you survived the Big Burn and had some memory of it, you'd probably have to be about 110 years old right now. And you know, I really loved in the Dust Bowl story looking into the eyes of someone who's 85 years old, mostly women because women outlive men, and saying, tell me what it was like. And they'd close their eyes and start to talk about this grass, this gorgeous grass, and then how the dirt came down and how their life was slowly snuffed, you know, one thing blow after another, the depression, then the earth itself turning on them. And I would try to imagine this 85-year-old person as a, not as an old person, but as a 17-year-old girl, you know, in the blush of life, just getting married. Well, with the Big Burn, I didn't have that, but there's fabulous archival stuff. The Forest Service, because this was, and I say a near-mythic event, meaning that, you know, it was their founding myth. You know, every family, every nation, you know, every sort of, you know, great organization has a founding myth, and this was theirs. So they did a really good job of recording it. Getting memories of the people who fought those fires, and terrific pictures, too. So there's really good archival stuff. And then the other thing was, and I want to point this out, Teddy Roosevelt and the nation's first forester, a guy named Gifford Pinchot, were fabulous writers and fabulous diary keepers. Roosevelt himself wrote 14 books before his 40th birthday. Pinchot wrote just volumes and volumes of diaries. And by the way, he was an interesting guy. He was married to a ghost for 20 years, too. Reflecting his times. But you basically had two rich guys, Pinchot and Roosevelt, raised, you know, in privilege in New York City, who, you know, created the American Public Lands Endowment. So I just love that backstory part of it.
And did this fire play a role in the next presidential election when Roosevelt tried to take the presidency back?
Yes, it did. It galvanized all the conservation forces, which had been on the run and somewhat dispirited. They actually had a rousing conservation congress about 3 weeks after the fire, in which Roosevelt gave this fire and brimstone speech with his spectacles all steamed and mentioned the fire, and that because of the fire they were more committed than ever to public land. And that same conference, Taft spoke and was basically booed. So it played a very big role. Taft only won six states in the coming presidential election. Roosevelt should have had the Republican nominee, but the mainstream Republicans decided he was too progressive for them. He ran, as you know, as an independent on the Bull Moose Party and got more than any independent has received ever in the 20th, well, in any time in the 20th century. I think he got 27% of the vote. Ultimately, Woodrow Wilson won, but it was a big deal in the election.
Well, the book is called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America, and the author is Pulitzer Prize winner, National Book Award winner, Timothy Egan. And now, of course, the highlight of your career, you've been a guest on From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Gary, it was an absolute pleasure. I appreciated it.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program, and I hope you'll tune in next week for another fine show. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And thanks to Timothy Egan for joining us this week. Check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night, everybody.